clear. You're able to see the tightness when it first starts to arise. The easier it is to let go and stay on your object of meditation. As you stay on your object of meditation for longer periods of time, this is what most people call concentration. And in reality, it is a form of concentration, but it's not one-pointed concentration, because that tightness can come up at any time. When your mindfulness isn't sharp enough, when your mind starts to dull out a little bit, then that whole process will happen again, and now you have to work with the hindrance again, and now you have to see it more and more clearly. But as you stay on your object of meditation and you let go of the hindrances, you start to experience relief, joy, happiness, tranquility of mind. Your mindfulness is very sharp. But when it starts to dull out again, then that tightness starts again. And if your mindfulness is you weren't aware enough, you didn't see that tightness, you didn't see the movements of mind, you didn't see the thoughts, and you didn't see them getting bigger until they pulled you away. So now you have to go backwards and start letting all of this stuff go, coming back to your object of meditation and watching that process again. But the nature of our mind is it likes to be attached to all different kinds of thoughts and emotions. So if one kind of emotion didn't work, it'll pull up another one and distract you with that one for a while, and you can get caught. But when you become more and more familiar with this process, the easier it is to let go of all of the attachments. So your mind stays more in the present moment all of the time. Now, the beauty of the four foundations of mindfulness is that it doesn't only have to do with sitting in meditation. The hindrances come up the same whether you're out there doing something or you're sitting here in meditation. When your mindfulness gets good, you'll be able to recognize this in your daily life. So, a sight or a sound or a taste or a touch, a smell or a thought can arise. And if it arises, and then that tightness starts, and then the thoughts and the tightness bigger, and the thoughts bigger, and then you're attached to one of the sense doors. Now you treat it in the same way. You keep on letting go. You let go of the sight. There's nothing worth seeing and being attached to. Now, that doesn't mean if you see a beautiful sunset, you can't appreciate it. You can. But you let go of all the tightness in your mind. And you see it completely because you don't have thoughts interfering with what you see. Now, the seven factors of enlightenment are very important. And I've had Vipassana teachers tell me that the only time you really are able to experience the seven factors of enlightenment is when you become enlightened. But that doesn't agree with what I just read in the Satipatthana Sutta. The first factor of enlightenment is mindfulness. Now this is a word that might be overused a little bit for Buddhists. Everybody has a different idea of what it means to be mindful. But The definition of mindfulness is interested observation. Okay, when you're interested in how processes work, that means you're going to watch them a little bit more closely. And that's what mindfulness is. Now, the second factor of enlightenment is investigation of how the experience arises. Investigation. You have to look at it, and you don't mentally analyze it by thinking about it, but as you see it, you begin to recognize. Now, the third factor of enlightenment is energy. As you watch more closely how the process works, it takes more and more energy to see more and more closely. And this is a natural thing. The more interest you have in how the process works, the more energy you have to want to see more of it. The next factor of enlightenment is very important. Now, it's put in the middle. There's seven factors. There's three on one side, three on the other side, and there's this one factor in the middle. Joy. The enlightenment factor of joy is when you finally see how the process starts to work, there's a relief that happens. And you start feeling happy because you're actually starting to see how all of this works. And that joy helps your mind to be very light and alert. It's not a big kind of joy, like, oh, wow. But it's just, oh, this is how it works. And your mind just becomes lighter. And it becomes happy because you're actually starting to figure out how consciousness and how this mind and body process really does work. Now, when the joy, it'll be there for a period of time. And it'll fade away a little bit. You'll still have some joy. But when that fades away a little bit, you feel very, very tranquil. And tranquility is the next factor of enlightenment. As your mind becomes more and more tranquil, your mind also becomes more and more still, more composed. And people can call this one-pointed concentration, but it's not the same. Because there's more awareness. You're not so deep into the one-pointed concentration that you can't see this. You can see it very clearly. We can call this a mind that is very composed. It's still. It's calm. It stays with your object of meditation. You have that. It's tranquil and it's still. Now, the last factor of enlightenment is equanimity. And that means perfect mental balance. That's what equanimity actually means. It means a mind that's not wobbling like this. It's a mind that's still and it's balanced, and whatever arises, your mindfulness sees it. You start letting go of the tightness and tension. If you don't see it right at first, you have to investigate a little bit more clearly. When you do that, your energy picks up. When your energy picks up, there's the relief of letting go, and the joy arises. As the joy fades just a little bit, tranquility. As the tranquility gets stronger, mind becomes more and more composed. With that composed mind is perfect balance. Now, I just explained to you all of the four foundations of mindfulness. When you follow this, you will know a deeper happiness than you've ever known before. And when we're talking about the Four Noble Truths, the first noble truth is there is suffering. It's suffering when a hindrance arises and you don't see it and you get caught by it. What's the cause of the suffering? Tightness and tension and the want to control. The cause of suffering is craving. The third noble truth is when your mindfulness is strong enough, and that is the cessation of suffering. There is no suffering when you see exactly how your mind works and you keep on opening and relaxing. Whenever there's the slightest little bit of tension and wobble, your mind, you see that and you relax. And that's the cessation of suffering. And the fourth noble truth, what I've been talking about this whole time, is the Eightfold Path. And we'll get into that more later. So the four foundations of mindfulness is the true base to be able to see so that mind can become completely awake. Now we have the next one is talking about the four great efforts. Now the four great efforts, this is part of the Eightfold Path. And it says, here a monk arouses his will. Boy, I'm not sure I like that. Makes an effort, stirs up energy, exerts his mind, and strives to prevent the arising of unarisen, evil, unwholesome mental states. What does that mean? The unwholesome mental state is when that tightness really happens and your mind gets pulled away. And you get caught by one of the hindrances. Now your mind has unwholesomeness in it. Why is it unwholesome? Because you're identifying very strongly with those thoughts and with those feelings. You're taking them personally. But when you see clearly how the process works, when you let go completely, you've let go of all the unwholesome states because you're seeing everything as process, not as I am this. It is my feeling. Every hindrance has I attached to it. Now, the I can be greed or lust. I want. Or it can be aversion or hatred. I don't want. Or it can be that dullness of mind, sleepiness. I'm sleepy. I'm dull. Or it can be restlessness or anxiety. I'm restless. Or it can be I don't know, doubt. Now, when the hindrance takes you, the reason that this is called a hindrance is because it stops you from meditating. You're not meditating when you're caught by a hindrance. You're meditating when you recognize that you're caught and you let it go and relax and then come back to your object of meditation. When you're staying on your object of meditation, you are meditating. But the hindrance, you get so involved in thinking about something or planning or in an emotional state that you forget everything else, and you just get into this emotional state, and the emotional state can be an unpleasant feeling or an unpleasant memory. It can be any kind of emotion that just grabs your mind and you become attached to it. And then you remember I told you the five aggregates, we have feeling and we have thoughts. That's when we get into our old habit of trying to think the feeling. And control the feeling with the thoughts. But again, feelings are one thing, thoughts are something else. As we let go of the thoughts and relax, we're starting to let go of the attachment. Starting to. As you let go of that tight mental hold and allow the feeling to be there by itself, even though it hurts and it's unpleasant, it's all right for it to be there. Because the truth is, when it arises, it's there. That's the truth. Anytime you try to fight with the truth, anytime you try to control the truth, it causes more and more suffering to arise. So, when you allow the truth to be there, without trying to make it one way or another, just open up and relax into it. And let go of the tightness. Then you can come back to your object of meditation again. But the nature of these hindrances is the attachment is strong. And your mind's going to keep bouncing back and forth with it a little while. But as you take an interest in how it happened, then you start letting go little by little of the attachment to it. Because you're not taking it personally anymore. It's just part of this process. And it's an impersonal process. Nobody is going to say, well, I haven't been angry for a while, so I think I want to be angry, or restless, or have a dull mind. They happen because the conditions are right for them to arise. Why do you get a dull mind? Because you get a little bit lazy, and you just kind of ho-hum. And the energy goes down, and then you're caught. But when you have very sharp interest, when you're investigating how it works, your energy will pick up, and that dull mind just goes away by itself. So anytime you get caught by a hindrance, that's called an unwholesome state because there is that personal attachment to it. I am that. Okay, he strives to overcome evil, unwholesome mental states that have arisen. How do you strive to do that? By noticing it, letting it go, coming back to your object of meditation, and then start looking at the process of how it gets taken away again. And he strives to produce unarisen, wholesome mental states. Now, what's an unarisen, wholesome mental state? It's that mind that has no tightness and no tension in it, that mind that you're bringing back to your object of meditation. And then you strive to maintain wholesome mental states that have arisen, not let them fade away, to bring them to greater growth, to the full perfection of development. How do you do that? By watching when the slightest tension arises and letting it go and staying on your object of meditation. That's the complete wholesome state. That's the pure mind. Now, I know there's some difference between the Mahayana way of describing this and the Theravada way of describing this, but according to the Theravadins, this is called voidness. Doesn't mean there's not an object of meditation. It means that there's no tension or tightness. There's no false idea of a self. And when there's no false idea of a self, that means it's void of that. And that's why it's called voidness, according to the Theravada Buddhists. I don't understand the Mahayana idea of voidness. Nobody's been able to explain it to me well enough that I really understand. So we won't go into differences on that. Now there's four roads to power. The kind of power that he's talking about here is psychic power. Developing your psychic ability. Here a monk develops concentration. We'll stop right there and replace the word concentration with composure, stillness, but not one-pointed. Concentration of intention accompanied by effort of will. Now what this is talking about, the effort of will, is when your mind is on your object of meditation and you start to see tightness arise, you have a choice right then. Either you can let go of that tightness, or if you don't, then you can watch how everything else builds up and pulls your mind away. But this is where free will is. If your mindfulness is sharp enough, you will naturally see that tightness and you'll let it go. If your mindfulness is not sharp enough, it dulls out a little bit, then your mind gets pulled away from your object of meditation. Now, the whole idea of free will, when they start talking in Abhidhamma, they get completely lost, as far as I can see, because they're trying to say that there is something of free will, but there isn't at the same time. But according to the suttas, we have to drop the Abhidhamma because that's just intellectual gymnastics. According to the sutta, the free will happens at the moment of your awareness seeing any change. And what you do with that. Opening up and letting go and allowing, staying on your object of meditation is part of free will. Or dulling out and not seeing it. It's your choice to be completely mindful or not. And that's what the free will is talking about. Yeah. The free will actually doesn't talk about it directly, but it talks about the five hindrances. Now, it also talks about the five aggregates. Half of the time in the suttas, when it's talking about the aggregates, they say the aggregates affected by clinging. That means by thoughts. But I don't like that translation very well. And they always use that. Aggregates affected by clinging. If I was to write the suttas over again, I would say the aggregates that may or may not be affected by clinging. And when you say may or may not, that's where your free will is. Now, it takes a lot of energy. It takes one of the reasons that it seems that when you start practicing meditation, that it seems like it takes a long time before you build up momentum. Is because it does take a lot of energy to be able to see how the process works. And when you first start meditating, your mind is moving at such big swings. You can't see the process very well. It takes a lot of energy to let go and finally relax and come back to your object of meditation. Over a period of time, as you build up your energy, you're able to see a little bit more clearly. your mind becomes a little bit more alert. And this is part of discipline. A lot of people will come and want to learn how to do the meditation, because they have this idea, if I meditate, I'm going to be calm and I won't have any problems. And then they come and they see the vast movements of their mind and they say, oh no, this is too hard, I can't do that. They don't want to put any energy into really seeing what the teacher is trying to show them. It takes a lot of energy. And the more and more subtle the mind gets, the more energy it takes. But you're so used to putting out that energy that it doesn't seem like it takes much at all. It's just like building up your muscles. At first, when you start building up your muscles get sore. They don't like that. But as you do it more and more, you get stronger, it becomes much easier just to do it. And you're building up your mindfulness muscle when you do the meditation. Now, he keeps on using concentration of consciousness, concentration of energy, concentration of investigation, concentration of effort of will. And I don't like that word concentration, even though here you can kind of use it. It means a gathering up of, being able to focus. When you have a lot of people and you spread them over a big area, that's not a very concentrated area. But when you pull them all together and they're touching each other, then you could say that's a concentration of people. And this is the sense that he's using with the word concentration here. Now, the concentration of consciousness means the awareness of how the process works, the awareness, the mindfulness. People get mind and consciousness mixed up. Mind is the thinking part, and consciousness is the awareness of. It's the awareness. Now, the concentration of investigation, accompanied by effort of will. In other words, you want to direct your mind so that you can see how everything works, so you can see the process. You investigate it. One of my teachers, when he started talking about the seven factors of enlightenment, the second factor he called, other teachers always just say, it just means investigation. But he made it a little bit more clear when he said, investigation of your experience. And what does that mean? It means seeing the process. Investigating how it arises. Now, we're going to go into a more interesting thing, I think. And we're going to start talking about jhanas. The four jhanas. Here a monk detached from all sense desires, detached from unwholesome states, enters and remains in the first jhana. Now, the becoming detached from sense desires. A lot of people that start meditating and they hear that you have to be detached from sense desires, they say, I don't want to be detached from sense desires. I like sense desires. I like touch, and I like sight, and I like sound. But while you're meditating, especially while you're sitting, you close your eyes. Where's the sense pleasure of seeing? It doesn't arise. Why? Because your eyes are closed. If you hear a sound, if you taste something, if you smell something, if something touches your body, if a thought arises, there's just seeing that your mind got pulled to it and letting it be and relaxing and coming back to your object of meditation. In other words, you're not caught in the thinking about that sense pleasure as it arose and become involved in it. And that's how you become detached. Now, with your daily activities, you're going to get caught by the sense pleasures. A nice taste arises from food you eat, and immediately there's tightness that happens and all kinds of other things. This process works in the same way. But then you're going to be caught by thinking, oh, that was lovely. I really like that. I want some more of that. That was like what I had last time, and I really liked it then. And then your mind takes off and thinks about something else, and thinks about something else, and you're away from your true experience of tasting because your mind becomes so distracted. That's the nature of mind. Once a thought arises, then another one follows, and another one follows, and before you know it, you're 1,000 miles away. So, when you become detached from the sense pleasure, you eat something, and your mind says, oh, that's really good. And then you let it go and relax and enjoy it completely without being pulled away by thinking about it. And by relaxing any tension or tightness. And then you have the full experience. Because most times, people say a mango that's incredibly good. Most times, somebody will eat a mango and they'll really like it. And it was really sweet, really good. And then you start thinking about, wow, I got to get some more of that. That's really good. I can do all kinds of these mangoes. And then you're thinking about something else and thinking about something else. And it's the cause of getting pulled away. And you're not really experiencing the mango anymore because you're thinking. Even though you take another bite of the mango, you're still not with it completely. A glutton? But there... people that are gluttonous are more interested in the feeling and liking the feeling and thinking about the feeling and getting just thinking about other things. That they keep doing it, they keep putting things in their mouth, but they don't really realize that that's what they're doing. They just know that this feeling is good and they want more of it. Okay? So when you have any one of the sense doors arise, a beautiful sight, an ugly sight, a beautiful taste, an ugly taste, a beautiful smell, an ugly smell, a beautiful sound, an ugly sound, a beautiful thought, an ugly thought. As soon as you notice it, you relax into it. Now your mind is in the present moment. It's not dwelling on all of the effects and all of the thoughts attached to that. That's how you become detached from the sense pleasures. And that doesn't mean that you can't enjoy it in the present moment. You can. But there's nothing pulling you away from the present moment anymore. You're just staying in the present moment. You're seeing how it works. How does taste work? Have you ever noticed? What happens first? What happens right after that? just taste. How does taste arise? Where does the taste of mango arise on your tongue? I know. I can show you exactly. Right there. How do I know that? Because I watched it. What's the first taste that arises when the taste of mango comes up? No? What's the taste? Sour first. Sour. And then sweet. Then a little bit of salty taste. Now, each one of these different tastes are on different parts of your tongue. How do I know that? Because I watched it. That's how you investigate. Now, when you see that, you're not attached to it. You are detached. Because you're seeing how this process works. And it goes back to the back of the tongue. There's taste buds all over your tongue. But it's an interesting process when you investigate. When you take an interest in how the experience works. And it doesn't matter what sense door it is. How does seeing work? How does hearing work? I'll give you a clue. It always starts with a feeling. Then that feeling arises and the tightness starts. And then the thoughts about the feeling. Now, I just described to you dependent origination. That's how the process works. As your mind becomes more and more calm, you start seeing in much different, more precise ways. And everything becomes incredibly interesting. Okay, how do you become detached from unwholesome states? Letting it go and relaxing. Coming back to your object of meditation. Anything that has any tension arising in your body, at any part of your body, is the start of an unwholesome state. Now, you hear me talk a lot about the tension in your head, in your mind, because that's where the first one starts. Sometimes it can come into the shoulder, sometimes it can come into the back or the knee or whatever. But there is more tensions that arise. And those tensions are caused by the false idea of this being a personal thing. This is mine. It doesn't work like that. When you let go of the tension, then you see very clearly there's no tightness anywhere in your body. There's only this pure mind. And as you bring this pure mind back to your meditation, your mind over a period of time will start to stay on this wholesome object of meditation, being extremely mindful, alert, and observant. Meditation is by far the best show in town. It's more interesting than any entertainment that you could ever come up with. When your mind begins to settle down and you start to get into the jhanas and you start to see the process more and more and more clearly, as your mind goes deeper into your meditation, you go to the second jhana. When it goes deeper, you go to the third jhana. When it goes deeper, you go to the fourth jhana, where there's perfect equanimity in your mind. You see everything in a different way. And it becomes more and more interesting. More and more fun to watch it. Now, the difference between the one-pointed concentration and the tranquility concentration is, when your mindfulness, even if you're in the fourth jhana, starts to slip a little bit and you're not as aware as you could be, then you're not in the jhana anymore and a hindrance comes up. This is how it works. Then you have to work with that till you can let it go. But you start seeing everything as process. And it's completely fascinating. Every different sense door has aspects to it that are incredibly interesting if you take the time to look at them. But most of the time, we're moving around too fast, we're getting caught by our thoughts too much, and we're not very aware. Now, what's the advantage of doing a meditation retreat? You do a meditation retreat because that's the time to slow down and spend your time continually watching the process and letting it go, relaxing. And then you start seeing things in more and more deeper ways. Now, as I was talking about the hindrances before, when you let go of a hindrance, you're letting go of an attachment. And attachment takes up space in your mind. And this attachment clouds the way you see the world and the way you react to the world. So when you let go of a hindrance, you've let go of this attachment. There's a little space there. But nature doesn't like a vacuum. If you don't believe me, clean off your desk and watch how long it takes for things to start piling up on it. You can clean that baby off clean. Nothing on it. And you come back the next day and it's got piles of stuff on it. Nature doesn't like empty spots. So what it does is it takes this pain from the attachment and it replaces it with the opposite, joy. And there's five different kinds of joy. Three kinds of joy happen for anybody at any time. Doesn't matter whether you meditate or not. These kinds of joy can arise. The first kind of joy is, it's a little happy feeling, but you get goosebumps. They call it goose flesh. And it's there for a moment and disappears. But it's a pleasurable thing. The next kind of joy, it's like a flash of lightning. It's very intense,